The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
C. Derek Varn is a reader at Zero Books, a poet, blogger, and podcaster. His podcasts include Symptomatic Redness and Former People, and he is a frequent guest on Zero Squared. This week, we have yet another politically incorrect conversation about the dysfunction of a political discourse that all too often can be reduced to an opposition between trolls and Tumblrites. It's Wednesday, February 17th, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. Jordana Elizabeth is appearing at Another Words Bookstore today. She'll be reading from her book, Out from Zero Books, entitled Don't Lose Track, Volume 1. And she's been nice enough to invite me to take part and read from my book, After the Saucers Landed. If you're in Portland, I urge you to turn up at 7 p.m. It's at 14 Northeast Killingsworth. In this episode, you'll hear a fair use excerpt from Beyoncé's Formation, the voice of Slavoj Žižek, the voice of Professor Gregory B. Sadler explaining Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit, a piano version of the Nyan Nyan Cat theme, Woody Allen discussing Nietzsche, the late Terence McKenna, and Beethoven's Ode to Joy, as performed by a flash mob. Right now you're listening to Tom Breyer as he plays the Super Mario theme, Blind. But in just a moment, you'll be hearing C. Derek Varn and I discuss trolls and Tumblrites. You've written a couple of blog posts here called The Sour Grapes of the Body Politics or The Troll and the Tumblrite.
You know, I know people who listen to me from podcasts don't get this because all we ever do is talk about politics and occasionally art. But that I've been sort of depoliticized in a deep way. And at the same time, like, nothing's changed in my beliefs. I think I might be even more of a descriptive Marxist than ever. I say descriptive because I don't know what positive Marxist politics actually looks like. And in some ways, to talk about it as eschatology, to me, seems almost eschatological. And at the same time, from my vantage point abroad, the United States is getting both more predictable and harder to predict. The crisis in the DNC and the RNC is a long time coming, and it's totally related. It maybe has been stalled out by crises from the protest movements and the general economic business cycles. And the Democrats have been kind of riding high off of the end of a business cycle. Now, anyone who studies business cycles, be they a Marxist, an Austrian, or even a neoclassical, could have told you that if you look at short-form cycles, they generally are in 7-8-year rotations. That's just been the historical norm since the 50s. And the Dems are at the end of one. Now, you can see on the horizon a couple of things. And this is why I'm actually talking about this, because I don't really think a lot of this electoral politics actually matters. I think most of it's spectacle. But what I see is the kind of – there's a kind of a backlash against a certain politics of outrage and, you know, what your conservative friend on your show a few weeks ago called virtue signaling, which is actually probably an apt way to call it. I kind of called it, progressive cultural capital mongering, but it's really the same thing. And I think that's sort of dying down. And there's a backlash against it hardcore. But ironically, the backlash actually kind of functions the same way that virtue signaling does. And again, this should surprise us. If we look at the way, say, the Reagan people operated in relationship to the boomer counterculture and the new left, you know, Reagan actually read Solzhenitsyn and used it. We shouldn't be surprised when Trump does a lot of the same things. And in fact, Trump being a creature of media like Reagan is probably the best analogy for him, even if Trump isn't really a conservative in any meaningful sense. Yeah, Reagan kind of was, but even then it was more media than anything else. I mean, like, he knew how to play the Goldwater stuff. Trump's not even doing that. But you look at the Reagan coalition, what you can see from a kind of Marxist perspective is sort of a waning portion of the capitalist class and of the managerial class is sort of coalescing together. You have conservatives, religious and otherwise. You have Sunbelt libertarians. But all these powers were actually kind of on the way out even then. And they definitely are now. I mean, when we talk about, let's say, the Koch brothers are odd because they're literally like the last super rich remnant of the old Sunbelt money powerhouses. Everything else has moved into finance. And at the same time, you've seen kind of a popular revolt against the Democrats, but interestingly, it can't even call itself that, because that's nowhere to go. If you think about Occupy, Occupy's conditions really brought it about. It's ironically similar to what brought about something like the Tea Party, which is also dead. But in that it started off as a revolt against its own side. It didn't see itself as that, but the failures of Barack Obama is crucial to this sort of late 90s, early aughts, pre-9/11 politics that really was the core of Occupy reemerging. And that's gone now. It really is. And we should have seen it go because there was tensions then with kind of, you know, identity purity movements. Again, that comes out of the late 90s, but the way it's phrased in the vocabulary has completely changed. You know, I've kind of been talking about the gradual shift in the vocabulary over time from sort of new left to sort of quote-unquote PC culture to standpoint, vulgarization of standpoint theory, which itself is from the 70s and 90s. But you've seen it more become more and more individualized. Ironically, this has led to populist revolts on both sides. If you look at the populist revolts on the right, you have the celebration of individualism that takes form in just blatant celebrations of what is essentially a mob. It is all about collective identity, real America, and all that shit. But that's actually a fundamentally mob mentality, and it does that while talking about individualism. That's still true in Trump, although Trump doesn't play the individualism as much. Conversely, we've had this kind of weird schizophrenia in the popular left where we're constantly talking about structural issues, but we're always focusing in on individual consciousness and individual privilege as if it was some kind of miasmatic sin. And we think we can bring about the revolution by just purging this consciousness problem. So actually fundamentally individualistic, even though it's claiming to be about structural issues. Well, structural issues are really about consciousness in a lot of ways.
You hear a lot about structures on the left, like structural racism. But what you don't ever hear, or very rarely hear, is any elaboration of how the structure is put together or how it works. Is there something I'm missing from that Coates or another anti-racist theorist has as a model for how, say...
Coates kind of did it in the talking about reparations when he talks about the black, you know, disenfranchisement of black property. But then he doesn't really go into anything like any other political economy around that. And actually, increasingly, Coach uses this as a moral argument. And in fact, in the last month, I feel dishonestly so. I'm not a fan of Bernie Sanders, but when he attacked Bernie Sanders for for being, you know, for making a strategic critique of reparations. And Sanders' critique of it was strategic. It wasn't moral. He did attack Hillary Clinton for the same thing. And in fact, I think he said Hillary Clinton was for it, even though she's on the record as not being for it, and even took money from lobbyists. Now, this isn't new again there either. You think about Tim Wise. Tim Wise did the same thing. His way of explaining structural racism was privilege. And that's a problem because it's circular. What is privilege? Privilege is the result of structural racism, right? How can the result of structural racism be the cause of structural racism? So privilege, even if one takes it as a valid, you know, metaphor, and it is a metaphor, by the way, it's not just an abstraction, it's a metaphorical abstraction going back to W.E.D. Du Bois, The Wages of Whiteness. And Du Bois was explicit about it being a metaphor. When it came out in the Invisible Knapsack article, by a teacher, it was a metaphor then, too. It got literalized very fast, even by the people who came up with the metaphor. But it was kind of a teaching tool. And in that sense, I think it could have been defensible. But if you use it as a theory to explain the thing that it describes, you really haven't gotten anywhere. I mean, it's basically it becomes tautological. Tautologies are not explanational, they're definitional. And so it's not particularly useful. I think the problem a lot of people have with actually elaborating a critique of structural racism is that it actually does remove a lot of individual agency in the current. And it also separates out individual bigotry racism and structural racism, and not in a way that they aren't related. But you can literally have one and not have the other. And that seems like something that's anathema to the simplification of this theory that we have right now. So, you know, I can be a bigot, and I could fight for, you know, justice for black people. And I mean, in a way, the release of that problematic Harper Lee book actually is about just that thing. Something that we have trouble even admitting exists. Conversely, I can be an anti-racist deeply and profoundly, and because of my position in capital, I could be perpetuating structural racism all over the place. And I guess people are more comfortable with the idea of that. But even then, you hear that kind of acknowledged, but never really discussed on what that would mean.
What it means is, when people talk about that kind of thing, what it means is it doesn't matter how many times you make the claim not to be racist, you're still racist. It doesn't mean anything materially, because there is no material analysis.
If I talk about that, I might say that, you know, I might be guilty of subconscious racial bigotry. I think most people actually are. That's probably true. Even though I'm, I would consider myself generally against racism.
Yeah.
Like, generally not useful, if anything else. But I also might talk about systemic problems, you know, from poverty that disproportionately affect minority groups, particularly African Americans. And may also even agree with someone like John McWhorter about, you know, the cultural effects of poverty, but I'll disagree on John McWhorter that all you have to do is like act better or dress better or talk better or whatever. But I still might see that John McWhorter, for example, actually respects the African American community maybe more than some of the anti-racists seem to, because he does think that they're essentially capable of everything else. And that while they have been historical victims, he doesn't deny that. I've seen some people claim that he does, but I've actually never found any place where he's denied that.
No, he doesn't deny that.
He sees it's their own communities, you know, role to de-oppress themselves. Now, that's maybe naive, but that's actually not that un-Marxist of a point of view. The working class is victimized, but the working class doesn't just ask the bourgeoisie to, like, give it a few things and liberate itself. We used to call that trade union consciousness as a slur for a reason, because that makes you dependent on the very success of the thing that is oppressing you. And that's true for a lot of these activists, I think. And that's kind of my point. You know, the strange thing when you, like, talk about these identitarian movements, in one sense, they want to fight racecraft and abolish, you know, racecraft and gendercraft and abolish race and gender. And another thing, they're absolutely dependent on race and gender to exist, right? Particularly if they're professionalized. Because you need that thing to fight against, because your identity is fighting against it. If you win, you actually have abolished your own identity, and that's a problem. That's a psychological problem. It invokes terror management. It reminds us of death. I mean, even to be a little bit critical of Marxists, I think sometimes Marxists who are completely unwilling to be critical of workers are slightly guilty of that too. We know the thing about the proposition of Marxism is the whole point is not like that the workers rule so the workers could have a better life. Yeah, that is part of the point, but that's not the main, that's not the only issue. There aren't supposed to be a class of workers anymore.
Right.
Once you're
Yeah.
Now, and I can't imagine a lot of, say, liberal feminist politics. I'm not going to blanket condemn feminism here because there's way too many kinds. But I can't imagine certain kinds of liberal feminist politics actually abolishing their gender position, or even what they would mean by that, frankly. I don't even know. Yet, if they're analogous to the Marxist position that you want to get rid of oppressing by getting rid of that whole category, that should be the goal.
Horizon of the political, the so-called identity politics, or more broadly, the politics of recognizing the differences, of tolerating differences. The logic of multicultural struggle, of anti-racist struggle, of sexist struggle, struggle against sexism, is again the logic of recognizing differences. For example, in anti-sexist struggle, the goal, of course, is not, even for radical feminists, I don't know, to kill, to annihilate men. It's to establish an open field within which both sexes, all different sexual positions, sexual identities, cultural identities inclusive, will be allowed to thrive freely, so that one will not articulate itself at the expense of others. Again, in the anti-racist struggle, the ultimate horizon is that of opening up the space for differences. Each ethnic group, religious group, cultural group, way of life group should have the freedom to freely deploy, articulate its potentials, its position. But this conceptual field, the field of openness towards the other, of tolerating, allowing for differences as the ultimate ethical horizon, this, I claim, cannot be our ultimate horizon. Because we can immediately see that, to use the simplified example, class struggle. My God, the ultimate goal of the class struggle is not for proletarians to allow the bourgeois and bourgeois to allow proletarians to freely deploy their own potentials and so on and so on. It's an antagonistic struggle. The goal is not to let the multitude be. The goal is to annihilate the enemy. It's a totally different logic. It's the logic of animosity. It's the logic of antagonistic struggle, which also involves a totally different notion of universality. The notion of universality here is no longer universality as the encompassing medium container of the plurality of positions, sexual positions, cultural positions, whatever. No, universality is here the universality of struggle itself. Thank you.
gender and sexual relations have been fundamentally changed by technology in a way that I don't think many people were really talk about. I do think there was a, still kind of is a school of Marxist feminist, and actually oddly also traditionalist, but they care about this for completely different reasons, who talk about, you know, reproductive labor, household labor, and a lot of the changes in male-female relations that went from actually somewhat logical, if oppressive, to illogical with changes in reproductive technology, changes in household cleaning technologies, et cetera, and so forth. You know, and even then, maybe, no, I don't know. In a certain degree, I think antagonism is eternal. I mean, and maybe this is where I'm not the most Marxist person in the world. I agree with you that the beginning of history of communism, as a lot of the Marxists used to say, not that communism was the end of history, but the beginning of it, when we wake up from a nightmare of history, I don't think it's going to be without antagonism. I actually don't. At all. I'm just hoping it's not class antagonism, and ideally also probably not racial antagonism. You know, and I hope maybe not as much gender antagonism, but regardless, there will be some antagonism there. Certain communist theorists thought that it was integral that there was this antagonism, and that was how communist society was going to move forward. Bordiga's organic centralism idea, I don't totally agree with, but was actually premised on this, that, you know, the party would contain these antagonisms, but you had to have an ideologically and nationally pluralistic party so that these antagonisms could play out within a communist system and also not lead to war. But that the antagonism itself would be the driving mind behind the evolution of communist society. Now, in a way, that's sort of trying to control a process in capitalism and, you know, its creative destruction. But we're getting off topic from, you know, the Tumblr and the troll. What I have found fascinating is the way these commodified identities have become super important as virtue signifiers, partly because the dissolution of traditional community and capitalism. I think a lot of Marxists have been undialectical about, you know, everything solid melts into air. That element of capitalism. It is probably good. I would, you know, I agree with you most days. Unlike, say, someone like Emmanuel Wallerstein, who actually seemed to have stated at one point that he would prefer feudalism to capitalism, which I think was nuts, that this dialectical tension is good, but it's not without externalities. And it's not all good. One of the things I talk about in the blog post is one of the fascinating things that's happening right now is in a moment where white privilege is being condemned the loudest and the most, it's also a moment where suburban and exurban, particularly men, but lower and middle class whites are actually catching up, are closing the gap with the black community and actually beneath the Hispanic community and longevity rates. And the reason why that is suicide and drug use. And diabetes, which to me are diseases of a lack of community. It's a kind of capital decadence. These also plague the black community, but the black community has actually sort of stopped declining in this regard and kind of plateaued out and gotten slightly better. Still worse than the white community. But the Hispanic community, which, you know, by most economic standards should be significantly lower, is not. It has a better longevity rate than middle-class whites.
So here, the thing about that kind of fact, what you're pointing to is the effect of capital's development. But what happens is if you start talking this way, that fact will immediately be taken up into a battle between what you say is that the trolls on one side, which is the right wing, and the Tumblrites on the other.
And the Tumblrites on the other. I refuse to call them social justice warriors because I think, you know, justice may be impossible, but at least it's noble. But yes, and the Tumblrites on the other. And yes, I mean, one of the things I mentioned in my story is the first thing that people turn to is, oh, this has got to be fake because a white privilege, or or worse, these white people deserve it. Like, that's an answer to anything. Or, oh, we got to stop helping the blacks because it's killing our own people. Both of these are kind of nuts propositions. I mean, it has nothing to do with that. It has to do with exurban blight, with the dissolution of the traditional communities, and the fact that it's, you know, affected the white community is actually kind of a sign of the white community's prior affluence, to be frank. Because the more affluent you are, the more these traditional structures have already been subsumed. You didn't need them. You had your community to work. Now that that's gone, you don't have anything. As we have said, you know, we both made this joke, I don't know, for 5 years now. You know, the only thing being worse than being exploited in capitalism is when no one exploits you anymore. Because then you just die. I mean, like, unless you own a bunch of stuff. So, and we're literally seeing that happen. And in the richest country in the world, I was thinking, I noticed this when I was in Oaxaca many years ago. Not many years ago, about two now. And I was going out to the peasant villages, and their way of life was actually like, dude, we would like try to help them build concrete, you know, cinder block ovens to cut down cancer rates. However, their criminality rates and their longevity was better than lower middle class and poor Mexicans in northern Mexico in the inner city, even though they were objectively way poorer. Like, the people in North Mexico were living off the equivalent of, like, $20 a day, which is still pretty obscene to think about. But the people, you know, when I was in Oaxaca, were living off about five, maybe less. If you counted up their labor hours, it was probably a lot less. But they still had a traditional community structure that was pre-modern, sort of helping them buoy it up. No, I don't want to sound like I'm, like, celebrating the pre-modern world, because all this is doomed. Like, it's not maintainable. And also, there are many negative things about this. And in some ways, you know, a more controversial fact I make in the sequel to that article that I also wrote today is a lot of people want their alienation. They need their alienation because the demands of the community itself is onerous. It just also means you're statistically more likely to survive a tragedy or a lack of income.
You're pointing out some problems in the kind of the traditional narrative, say, both of the racist right and the anti-racist left. It's easy to demonstrate that it's not affirmative action or welfare or anything like that that's causing the white working class to suffer. You can easily dispel that. You know, racism doesn't actually determine inequity only. It's not the only thing that's at play. But the real difficulty is we don't have an aim. We have this general aim of overcoming inequality, but we don't have an agreement on what that would mean. Let's say that what we want is everyone to be living the same level of poverty and income as Native Americans in this country. That would be a kind of equality.
Yeah, it would be equality. It would be the equality that the right always says they suspect the left really wanting, which is the lowest common denominator. Because, you know, Native Americans are really, like, as far, including being killed by cops, by the way, they are the most likely to get killed by cops. They're the poorest, the most given to alcoholism. They have the most rampant rates of criminality in some ways. And it's not because Native Americans are uncivilized or some bullshit like that. It's because they're, by and large, poor and kept out of the social order. And in fact, some of the worst racist comments I've ever heard said was by someone who was totally against anti-African-American racism. but would say horrible things about Native Americans. He was from Arizona, and not bad to call him out on it. I also remember like the Sui Park thing. One of the interesting things about the Sui Park thing, and it's even ironic now because she has abandoned social justice causes. I'll get to that on a different day. It completely erased a protest about about Native Americans. The whole controversy just buried that. So yeah, we could treat equity that way. We can treat equity by the cops killing everybody the same way.
But I don't think either side of the, you know, the trolls or the Tumblrites have a vision for what kind of society they want. Really.
Well, no, they do. I think this is where you're wrong. They want the society we have just to look more like them.
You think the trolls just want exactly the society that we have now? Only
not all of them. No, I mean this is an unfair statement, but I think that's not too far from each other. I mean, you and I both privately said one of the most weird things about a lot of men's rights activists and all that is how much they use the exact same language of social justice advocacy and how they probably even mean it. While, as you know, 95, like on problems on scale, most of the problems I mentioned are way smaller. But in another way, they're really easy to pick on because it seems so absurd. But that seems to be the way all this works. I mean, you think about the rise of German fascism. And fascism in general. One of the things that it always does, one of the things that this kind of nationalism always does, is to play up historical wrongs and to play yourself as the underdog while also claiming to be a superior
people.
Yeah,
well, I love that. I love that. I love how, on the one hand, whether it's, whoever it is, black nationalists, white nationalists, whoever it is, they always kind of make the claim, we are the best of the human race. Also, our natural abilities and powers and greatness has been oppressed by these bad guys over here who somehow are more powerful than we are, even though we're the best and the strongest.
Yeah, even though they're degenerate, we're the
most. Right, because no one wants to be on top and just say, yeah, everything's messed up because we screwed up. You know, it's our fault. And I mean, I guess there are some people who do say that. Those are real liberals, I guess. I don't know.
Real liberals or real conservatives. Joseph de Maistre. Now, I know people are going to freak out when they know I've read Joseph de Maistre. There's always people looking to accuse me of being some kind of secret right winger. But anyway, Joseph de Maistre said that the ancient regime is always going to fail. Because by the time there is something worth conserving, they have already screwed up. That it is already aware of its own decline. I think it's a pretty fundamentally interesting thing to say. Now, de Maistre is writing about bourgeois and socialists. I mean, and this is a time when bourgeois and socialists were loosely aligned in the French Revolution. But where bourgeois and socialist powers are really kind of taking down the last vestiges of feudalism. And his essential observation is like the feudalists don't think of themselves as conservative. They think of themselves as the norm. And by the time they think of themselves as conservatives, the culture has already changed against them. The conservative is always losing. Now, in that sense, and this is a reactionary saying this, in that sense, there's something profoundly interesting about that. We don't talk about the fall, you know, conserving capitalism. No one really talks that way. Except from conserving capitalism from itself, maybe. Capital's not of any risk in really losing right now. They're not going to conserve that. It's winning. It's the norm. We all sort of agree to it in some way, form, or fashion just by existing in the societies we exist in. And where it isn't the norm is like the third world. Or the developing world, use a more politically correct term, although they're both leftist terms, so whatever.
we need to begin with the immediate existence of spirit, the immediate existence of mind, the immediate existence of a distinctively human way of relating ourselves to things out there and ourselves and other people and the objects and ideas that we use to make sense out of things. And Hegel says that consciousness contains two moments that are going to be placed into antithesis with each other. They're going to split apart. And this is integral to the dialectical process as Hegel understands it, this doubling that takes place. But then there's an antithesis. The things stand against each other, and they look like they're just complete contradictions to each other. Notice that what we don't have here is thesis, antithesis, synthesis, right? Instead, we have two things as both being what consciousness is and an antithesis arising between them, which then has to be overcome. But it's going to be overcome over and over and over again in different ways. So we have knowing, knowledge, and in knowing, the subject is related to something else, which it knows. It takes it in. It makes it its own. For me to know what Hegel is talking about is for me to make that my own, to bring it within the sphere of my own consciousness, and to be in a certain way assured of it. And that's when we start sliding over into objectivity. The objectivity negative to knowing. When we think that we know something, can we actually be sure that we know it? Do we have knowledge of our knowledge? Do we have knowledge square? And what is it that we know? There is the act of knowing, and then there is the object of knowing. So we have all of these antitheses going on. Each time that we have something like this, these moments are incorporated. Spirit develops itself, explicates these moments, figures out for itself at that time, what is knowing for me now? What does it mean to know? What is objectivity, or what is the mode of the things that I'm actually trying to get out there and get to know, or get inside myself and get to know? It's going to come up with different answers at different points, and it's going to bring these two that seem to be totally irreconcilable back together into some sort of, not necessarily harmony, but some sort of synthesis. And he says they all appear as shapes of consciousness.
Shut the fuck up for the 50th billionth time! And if you'd fucking listen...
For example, yeah.
The MRA group. Can you shut the fuck up for a second, too?
Why are you making allegations?
Borrow phrase, you just use the proof is in the pudding.
So you just...
Shut the fuck up!
It is very frustrating right now. The thing is, though, we have so much backlash against everything. Everything's a backlash. I mean, in one sense, liberalism right now is doing that thing that we're talking about the fascists do. It is claiming victory and moral superiority at the same time claiming the inevitability of defeat and how it's been kept down. And in a way, all these Tumblr light and troll critiques, even if they don't mean to, they're defending the status quo. When we have big fights over whether or not it's progressive to have Ray or Poe Dameron or what's Boyega's character's name? Finn, you know, replacing the white boys of Star Wars, you're really missing the point. All that means is demographics that didn't have money now have money. And maybe that's a good thing, and maybe that's not a good thing, but because even by by them having money, we only mean a little bit of money. We do not mean, you know, they can survive even one healthcare crisis, economically speaking. So, I mean, what are we saying? What are we really valuing?
For me, the really key thing about those kind of cultural debates is that they replace a different debate, which is, why are we making the same movies over and over again, which you do hear about, but it's just a grumpy old man position, I guess.
When I talk about that on my art show with Stephen Mialkov, we always get, you know, basically called reactionary of artistic taste. But I really do want to know, like, why aren't there subculture movies anymore? We're beginning to have more black representation in mainstream cinema, but there's no black cinema anymore, or very little of it.
Yeah.
Even compared to, say, the 90s, and definitely compared to the 70s. Is it good or bad? I don't know. I really, truly don't. I don't know if it's a sign that things are getting better, or if it's a sign that we're just, like, you know, diversifying the face of the mainstream. But I don't know that I'm convinced that it means what people think it means. I mean, you know, one of the interesting things, we talk about diversity in comic books. Well, ironically, comic books like television are going through a heyday right now, artistically. You know why? They're dying. I mean, and seriously, popular medium forms tend to go through their biggest artistic creativity phases when they are at their lowest profit rates because they're desperate. And they'll let anything in. So our golden age of television is because people don't watch television anymore in the same way. They don't have to really build in mass demographics. They have to get whatever they can get. And so throwing the best stuff out there is the best way to do it. And conversely, what you see is the opposite of movies. Now, I make this point all the time. It seems like an old man point, but it seems to me like it's also something that Walter Benjamin or Adorno would have noticed. That what you're seeing is a, you know, something becoming a kind of monopoly commodity. And it's a monopoly commodity because the state has to protect copyrights. Otherwise, it doesn't work. It's not a real commodity because real commodities, their value has plummeted through the roof. Even conventional economists admit this. Even something scarce like oil is plummeting as a commodity. I mean, so the iron law of the declining race of profits always applies to real commodities. It doesn't always apply to intellectual commodities because intellectual commodities aren't really commodities without the state intervening as a monopoly function, which also means, ironically, one of the things about neoliberalism is while it's constantly decrying the state, it doesn't actually want to get rid of it. And this specific to neoliberalism is the only use of neoliberalism I think is valid. I think neoliberalism is probably the most abused word in left theory right now. Other than
on this thing about the movies dying or not dying, and television as an art form or as a communications form is dying, it seems to me like on the one hand, you're right that movies aren't going away. There's still lots of money there. But on the other hand, they haven't been growing at the same rate, and they're mostly looking at international audiences now.
You have to find new markets. After you primitively accumulate talent from those markets, like, you know, Korean animators, you eventually have to pay them the same wage. And you have to do that by expanding the market to the country so that you can bring in the money to pay them. And as that happens, your profit rates will go down and down and down. So while you'll need more, you'll need bigger and bigger blockbusters to risk the investment. So the only thing you can make is something that can, like, make the most money ever, because if you don't, you can't diversify your investments. But ultimately, you know this will fail because it'll burn out the audience. So it's not a long-term strategy either. And it's already kind of – I feel like it's already beginning to happen. But maybe I'm wrong. I mean, we've
– Star Wars is a huge hit, you know, huge, huge.
But these – kids of the last year are totally dependent on nostalgia.
Yeah.
That won't work for us. You can't have nostalgia for nostalgia about nostalgia.
millions of books written on every conceivable subject by all these great minds, and in the end, none of them knows anything more about the big questions of life than I do. Jeez, I read Socrates, you know. This guy used to knock off little Greek boys. What the hell's he got to teach me? And Nietzsche with his theory of eternal recurrence. He said that the life we live, we're going to live over and over again the exact same way for eternity. Great. That means I'll have to sit through the ice capades again. It's not worth it.
It's a quality of the time. I'm going to talk this afternoon more about the quality of the time. But we can't think any more clearly than we're thinking at the moment when we're thinking at our best. Part of what history is a clarification of the human situation. And I think you have to press the envelope. You have to keep your nose against the glass, forcing the definitions into every new territory.
We're radical publishers. We are dealing with the same dynamic as television industry and as the film industry, just on a much smaller scale with a different audience, right? But as publishers, we're dealing with the same issue. And I would say that maybe not as obviously, but still it's the case that activism, activist nonprofit groups and things also deal with the same economic conditions. So do you think that what's happened since the failure of Occupy is, and the way that the culture is divided up into trolls and Tumblrites, is a result of our psychological reaction to that failure and a cultural change, or is it economically driven?
Both. I mean, it's economically driven in that a lot of the cultural changes are economically driven, but the economics are also tied up to the culture, particularly when so much of the apparent profits, and I say apparent, because if you look at real profits, they're still in manufacturing and they're still very slim. The apparent profits are just movements of that slim margin in an increasing marketized world. But a lot of the apparent profits are in these cultural products. That's why the battle for them seems so important. But it's actually really superficial because it's not what drives the society. Now, you know, we can talk about the Frankfurt School a bit. And I think this was a big division within the Frankfurt School itself. Adorno and Benjamin really seem to see this coming. Perhaps they were too critical of the Enlightenment. Perhaps they weren't critical enough. You know, they did talk about more and more cultural things, and they sort of gave up on the worker. But the one thing they did see is that it was economic choices driving these cultural things, not the other way around. Marcuse, who was as much influenced by Heidegger as the Frankfurt School, is really the person who kind of flipped that equation. And when you really think about that, that's had profound effects on the left. When we talk about that, what we have to realize is that didn't just happen because a Marxist theorist made a mistake. It also perfectly correlates with the opening up of countercultural markets in the United States.
Mm.
Markets, by the way, that don't exist anymore, and why you don't see as much countercultural stuff. Because it's not as useful as a way to make marginal profits. The heyday of that was the late 90s, early aughts. That's pretty much over. And the reason why Marcuse could catch on so easily wasn't just that he was persuasive to delusions of the time. It's he also was useful in a market sense. Even if he opposed that market sincerely, that's irrelevant to his usefulness to it. And again, think about what I said about racism and anti-racism. Right. You could oppose racism sincerely and completely and still actually perpetuate a different kind of structural racism. And the same is true with capital. You can propose capital completely and still be a driving factor in it, which is something that should horrify most leftists, but it's very much true.